You're listening to the OneOfUs.net Podcast Network. Is there anything better than cracking open a cold beer and listening to your favorite podcasts? No, sir, and I'm here to tell you that the beer you should be cracking is one from our new sponsor, Circle Brewing, located in Austin, Texas at 2340 West Breaker Lane, Suite B. You can have a frosty one in their fabulous tap room where lots of seasonal specials await you, or you can get lots of their treats in the bottle or can at your local craft beer retailer. Try their award-winning Alibi Blonde or their diabolically rich Devil Knight Barrel Age Stout. They have so many solid choices, and they are the official sponsor of OneOfUs.net. Support Circle Brewing and support us, and we really need your support. There is no site without subscribers, and that depends on you. Please think about becoming a subscriber, because we cannot do this without you. The four different subscription tiers are there to give different flavors of bonus content, but we absolutely need your help, whether you sign up to give $2, $5, $10, or $25 a month. Don't be one of those people who loves something but won't lift a finger to keep it around. Help one of us and keep those podcasts coming. And I don't want to come off as an insensitive brute here, but really, will someone just buy this guy a real doll already?
You mean like the real doll?
Yeah, like one of those like life-size fuckable dolls, you know?
Oh my gosh.
Imagine the pictures if those are available.
Now that is an art installation. Seriously.
I think that's a Cindy Sherman exhibit you're all talking about.
We're talking about Welcome to Marwen, the new Robert Zemeckis film based on the 2010 documentary Marwen Call, so based on a true story, but filtered through the lens of Zemeckis and co. I am Chris.
I'm Frank.
I'm Alan.
I'm Marco.
Yeah, I will admit that like Zemeckis has definitely had a mixed career for me as a director. Mm-hmm. There's stuff he's done that I couldn't adore more, mm-hmm. and there's stuff he's done I'm like, I see what you're getting at. I see what you're trying to do, but I feel like you have a similar problem to, say, George Lucas, where you're so fascinated by what you could do, you never asked whether or not you should do it, you know, with technology.
He's always been a gearhead. I mean, he's always been one of those guys who's pushing technology to tell stories. But sometimes he doesn't find that right balance.
And I will say that that issue, the uncanny valley that has suffered with his animated films, certainly, where you're like, it's so real that it's disturbing.
Yeah, they can't watch Beowulf
I had less of a problem with that, maybe just because of the sheer fantasy element, than I did with the Polar Express for some reason. Everybody and the fact they look so much dead-eyed. Like the actors, yeah. They look dead-eyed. Yeah. But this one, something about the way that they're using that tech to fuse like these dolls and the actors' faces on them. Actually, the Uncanny Valley served it instead of hurt it, I felt like, because they're supposed to not be real. They're supposed to be imaginary. And for some reason, that worked for me, although I suspect a lot of people are still going to go zombie eyes.
Yeah. The execution of the dolls did not bother me at all. I thought, that looks great. That's exactly the right look.
It's the beautiful fantasy that he wanted, really.
It's the fact that they just constantly keep doing it over and over and over. And there's a much more interesting story here beyond the special effects.
Well, the baseline real story, although it's sort of delivered in dribs and drabs in the film and like a little bit later on, is that Mark Hogenkamp, real life guy, played by Steve Carell here, was attacked coming out of a bar by some neo-Nazi thugs who beat him up, left him for dead. He was really, like, I mean, just as he says in the movie, an inch from death, and had suffered such severe brain damage that he had lost all memory of any, you know, basically personal experiences, people he knew, personal memories of anything from before that date, even though he could still talk. He's, as he says, I can do the multiplication table still. All that stuff stuck with him, but any personal memories were just gone, wiped out of his memory, as well as physical damages to some extent, including he was an artist and was no longer able to do it anymore after that. And he found a way to filter and process sort of like things that he had tinges of memories of, and with trying to make his brain work again through creating this French town, Belgian town, called in real life, in the movie Marwen Call, here Marwen, that is populated by various G.I. Joes and Barbie dolls that he's dressed up and painted like exquisitely to resemble sort of people in his actual life. And he took pictures of them telling stories of like their adventures in this fictionalized, heavily fictionalized version of World War II that includes time machines and stuff. But it was his way of processing this stuff. And he went on to be a very successful, actually, gallery photographer with these pictures that he'd set up. He became a really good photographer on his own, where it's really an inspiring story, the original documentary. This takes us and sort of sets it at a jumbled up version of the tail end of that story, and then slowly starts to reveal like what all those details were over the length of the film, and intersperses it with, I would say intersperses the bulk of the movie is actually this sort of CG mocap thing of the dolls with the moving faces of the actors that are the characters that they're based on interacting in this town with Leslie Mann is the newcomer, Nicole, who's just moved in next door. Merritt Weaver plays Roberta, who works, who's a friend of his who works at the hobby store where he buys his models and figurines. Janelle Monáe has a small role as live action, but is a bigger part of the animated part, who is somebody he worked with in rehab. Liza Gonzalez is Karalala. Karalala? That's Marco, help me here. Is that correct?
I mind you, this guy makes up a lot of names. I don't know if that was a real name.
Okay, but works at the bar where he helps out a few times a week. Gwendolyn Christie, I did not realize that was Gwendolyn Christie. Yeah, plays his caregiver who is Russian and played to a almost distressingly comic extent.
Yeah.
And Diane Kruger is Deja Thoris, who seems to be the one person who's not actually based on anybody, but to him is sort of the Wicked Witch of the West of his fantasy,
the
Harbinger of Doom doll. But this is a movie that I think is going to confuse a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's,
I think it will.
Marketed as sort of a feel-good Christmas timey type release, and there's definitely stuff in here that I feel like that does that well, especially in the third act, which I thought pulled together a lot of elements that into something that eventually did kind of work, but there's a lot of stuff here that just feels like, well, wait, where did that go? You know?
Kind of, yeah. It's funny, this is his Christmas release. This movie feels like it's a movie that really isn't for any sort of time. And I kind of like that about this movie.
So it's timeless,
says Frank. It's timeless.
It's hard to categorize in a way.
It wants to be inspirational and feel good. And the original documentary, Marwyn Call, was all that.
Yeah.
And I think actually tackled this issue a lot more tastefully and a lot more dramatically, frankly, than this movie did. And it's really hard for me to talk about the things I have problems with without spoiling Marwyn Call, because you know what? That is such a fantastic documentary. It's worth seeking out. I will say that one of the things that becomes very clear in Welcome to Marwyn is something that takes a long time for us to get to in Marwyn Call. It's actually a bit of a surprise because we're kind of rediscovering Mark's past along with him. They take a different tack here where we get a much clearer idea of what happened and how he got into the situation he's in. And, you know, the real life guy was in a hospital for like a week and then he was in therapy for like a month and then he ran out of insurance and he kind of turned to art therapy and he created these elaborate stories that, you know, were meaningful to him. In the documentary, you don't see them. You see him staging them. You see him taking the photographs. You hear him explaining about them. And there's a magic and a mystery to it because you can't really get inside this guy's head. This is a movie that, because they have the technology, they go, we can literally show you these stories. The problem is these stories are very useful to Mark Hogan, but dramatically are not terribly interesting for the viewer.
Okay, see, that's where we actually differ on this one, because I actually really enjoyed watching those sequences play out.
Yeah.
I think if Mark Hogan Kipp actually watches this movie, he's going to be totally thrilled with that aspect of it, in fact, because like, this is what I was seeing in my head.
Is it?
You know,
I would say even if that's true, that's like one audience member may be completely satisfied, but for like...
Well, two and three.
Okay, yeah. Well, two and three. But like, for the most part, like, the first time was cool. The second time was kind of cool. by the fifth time, you're kind of repeating the beats, now you see, and it's just like,
the stories are very repetitive.
But what's so funny is that by the time we get to the seventh or eighth time, I didn't realize how invested I was in those sequences.
Yeah.
Like, I thought, wow, this went just beyond the little gimmick I thought it could be, and actually, like, wow, I'm actually caring about what's happening.
Because there's a point where it becomes inextricable from his feelings in real life towards these people, and as you're watching these fantasies play out, it becomes so much more clear as it goes along that what you're really watching is him trying to sort out his feelings and his thoughts about these people in his life.
Yeah.
And I actually, that's where I got drawn into it. I like the absurdity of them quite a bit, and the fact that, like, a lot of people are going to get unreasonably upset because they're like, you know, they're dames and they're like, yeah, they're all wearing sexy outfits, but that's, you know, the fantasy in this guy's head, you know, what are you going to clean that up when that's exactly what it was actually like?
The real Mark Hogan camp. And I like that they kind of give a little bit of time for this, because he's played by Steve Carell, and Steve Carell's always sort of kind of charming and a lovable dork and most things. The real Mark Hogan camp was kind of a mess when, you know, his story kind of began. This was a guy who, yes, he had been a talented artist, but he hadn't really been making any money off of it. He was, like, I think working in a kitchen. You know, he'd been divorced. He was an alcoholic, probably a pain in the ass. And he said the wrong thing to the wrong group of guys, and some bad shit happened to him. And as we find out, both in the documentary and in here, it's like, he's a little skeezy. He's a little bit old-fashioned, and, like, he likes to call girls dames, and he's like, you know, it's like, hey, this is my favorite porn star. And I'm like, oh, I didn't know we were getting into that level of intimacy.
But I like that they didn't clean him up.
But yeah, I would have liked more of that edge, because this movie, everybody seems to like Mark when they meet him. They're like, no one seems inappropriately creeped out by him.
I mean, I get why that stuff was chosen to be in here, because ultimately there's a situation between him and Leslie Mann here that if it had developed, if there that wasn't there, it would have made audience members uncomfortable that it didn't develop the way they would have wanted it to. But as it is, you're like, well, I really can't blame her for feeling the way she does.
Yeah.
So, like, that's a little odd.
She realized that he's more damaged than she realized. And, you know, and this isn't good.
I'm going to jump in here because I think that's the only scene in this entire movie for me that worked.
Yes.
Everything else in this movie for me fell completely flat. I'm actually surprised. You know, I thought it was like a disaster. Like, I couldn't believe I was watching the whole time. Like, I was in shock. Like, that this, like, got off. I mean, it was an idea to make this a narrative. Not necessarily a good idea, but it's an idea. And then, like, after the first script and the second pass and the third pass, like, how did we get to this place? And it was made with all this technology and money put into it. And it was just so undercooked. Like, everything about it was, like, not to even mention some really ill-advised movie references, some self-referential stuff in there.
Yeah. Which I love that. I love that Diane Kruger was so Isabella Rossellini from Death Becomes Her.
That's not what I'm referring to.
I can say, so you're doing a movie about this guy who really is an inspirational story, albeit a tragic one, and you don't really stop the movie cold to point out how awesome one of your earlier movies was.
Yeah. And I think that's, like, throughout the movie, not just that specific reference, but this movie is like the true story is a tragic, beautiful, somber story about humans and what happens to them when they're damaged and how they could overcome that. And this movie is just like a sugar-coated, feel-good Christmas release. I feel like all that stuff is just, it's weird how they treat the darker stuff in this movie. It's there, but it's not treated with any real heft or respect. Like, I had a real issues with it every time we come in. Like, it's some dark stuff.
A lot more edgy.
Yeah,
you should take your grandma to this, and she's like, "Why did you take me to this? But aren't you inspired?" Yeah, but he's kind of
grandma.
Creepy.
You love porn,
yeah, and shoes. Yeah, this is one of those things where they really capture that in the documentary, and here again, it feels like we're going to touch on some of the facts that some of the things about this guy that make you uncomfortable.
Yeah, but see, that's one of the.
But then we're going to sugarcoat it.
That's one of the things I actually like the way they dealt with in terms of the shoes thing. He has a shoe fetish, and he explains very well what it is. I mean, he's not even technically a transvestite. Mm. He likes putting them, but just and only shoes. And for him, it's a connection to the anima. You know, like his connection to women and. I like the way it plays out ultimately that it helps into that message of like about so seriously what is wrong with somebody who has that it's a little weird if you don't know anybody like that you're like wait what And the movie wants you to feel uncomfortable with it at first. And eventually, by the end, I was like, yeah, it's totally like, so what's the fuck's wrong with that?
Yeah,
to me, that's not the discomforting part.
Yeah.
To me, that's like, okay, no big deal. I'm kind of evolved enough that I can deal with that.
Right, I'm not saying that you guys had a problem with that. I'm just saying I like that aspect of it.
Did you just do a not that there's anything wrong with that?
No. Not there's anything wrong with you being completely bigoted.
That's right. I have a right to be a bigot. The president says so. No, I think what the fact that this guy is very obsessive, that he's sometimes very non-communicative, and at other times he has, you can tell that he's sort of misplacing or misunderstanding the affection that's coming his way, and thinking it's more than it really is, and that can be uncomfortable. I wanted this to be a much more uncomfortable film, because I think ultimately that would have made it feel more true, more inspiring, rather than this Hollywoodized version of it.
The problem is
it's halfway there.
Let's get really tragic.
The problem is
all about the tragedy.
It's a really
cool John Waters.
I get why they wanted to take it and try and give it that magical Hollywood thing, but it's a really difficult story to do that with. And there's a lot of huge missteps along the way in terms of scripting this thing, where you're like, what were you? Why wouldn't you have just stuck closer to the original story instead of transposing new characters that weren't even in there? And just like Leslie Mann is kind of a substitute here for Wendy, who is the woman
who
saved him in the bar, and she married him, but basically went, this is too much work.
She was his ex-wife.
Yeah. And she's a character in the Dolls in this movie, or at least she sort of is. You see her briefly, but he's kind of like, oh, she's dead. We don't do anything with her anymore. Like, she's out of his life. She is kind of that symbol of like, oh, I can never have love. I don't deserve to be loved thing. And I'm like, why didn't you just tell that story? I kind of felt like everything in there made more sense. And she is mentioned enough, but never with any sense of detail, that you're kind of like, wait, what is the deal with this whole Wendy character? Whereas Leslie Mann, like I said, she's just like kind of feels like an afterthought writing her in here. There's a lot of moments like that where I'm like, some of these side characters who are the Dolls, I'm like, I would have loved to have seen more sequences with the live action versions of these characters with their actual story in his life. But Zemeckis wants to tell the story of the Dolls. And the problem is inherent in that point where it becomes so clear that those stories are happening simultaneously, the Dolls and the metaphor for what's going on, that you do feel like you're just missing out on huge portions of what should have been in this movie.
And so much from the beginning, the clear metaphor that they're working with, things dealing with his various issues, addictions, whatever, like, it's so clear and obvious from the very beginning of the movie that watching it play out it's hard. It's laborious. It's like, let's get there. I see it. Like, I see it's all mapped out. Like, I know what this is representing, and this, like, metaphor from the Dolls to your life. And I'm not sure if the movie, I don't know if they trust the audience to already get that, or if they really think the audience is just stupid, where they're going to play it out and play it like a big reveal. And I know it's a big reveal for him, but like, there's a disconnect there. Like, you nailed it on the head. There's a huge disconnect from the Doll stuff to the human stuff. It's not balanced enough for me to have one affect the other. Like, they seem like two different stories happening at once rather than, like,
coalesce
together. Two different worlds. They're meant to be two different worlds and two different tones.
But yeah, but the tones, yes, but they're meant to be.
Yeah, as it goes along, they are meant to become sort of more and more integrated.
You know, they're commenting on each other throughout, and it's like one's talking to one, and the other one's, it's like a game of telephone. It's like not quite coming out the other end.
They spent too much time with the Dolls, which is all fun to watch, but nowhere near enough time representing these people, the real stuff that happened.
I also think that's how much time he himself wanted to spend in the real world versus versus Marwin.
I agree with you, that's what they're going after. But
it's very authentic, because someone who is going through that sort of stuff doesn't really want to spend that much time in the real world.
But I think in terms of telling the narrative story, it doesn't work. It really stumbled for me. But one of the worst stumbling points here is Alan Silvestri's score, which is treacly and over the top, and really just is just poorly chosen, like, music for this film that makes it feel like it's E.T. or something. And as well, the songs that they use, the period piece songs, every last one of them is so fucking on the nose. It's like, here's this song in the chorus, which describes something that person is feeling right now.
I had so much fun with the song choices in this movie. Like, the Addicted to Love sequence, I was just like all about it. I don't care. At me. I loved it.
Here comes the crazy ex-boyfriend. You know he's a douchebag because he wears a leather jacket, he drives a Volvo, and he listens to a Scorpions. I mean, come on. He listens to metal and stuff like that. It's like, as soon as that dude rolls up, you're like, he's an asshole.
Yeah, there was also, like, a domino in the movie that was set up and never really knocked down.
Yeah.
Like,
that could disappear.
It seemed like they were set up to some sort of catharsis there, but it was never really
He comes
addressed.
Back as a doll.
As a doll, yes, I guess so. But that's, again, my issue with
I didn't want to see the doll's ass get kicked. I wanted to see that guy's ass
get kicked. It wasn't satisfying.
Well, he's such a tiny, tiny part of the film, the real guy. Yeah. Like, him being so much a big part of the third act as a doll was just kind of like, don't have an emotional reaction to that particular doll, that analog of that character, because he's nothing in this movie.
It's rare when you get to see him, like, a finished movie and pinpoint, like, a couple characters that you can completely cut out and it wouldn't affect the movie at all. Mm-hmm. Like, all his scenes, all his interactions with Nicole and his interactions with Steve Carell's character, like, all that stuff could be completely cut out and it wouldn't change anything within the movie.
By the way, I realize it was just for the purpose of the stunt of, like, of transposing the name of the film to the documentary name of the film, but the idea of having Nicole have no E at the end of her name and it's still pronounced Nicole just bugged me consistently through the whole
Nicole.
Film.
Well, it would be Nicole.
It'd be Nicole, yeah.
Nicole.
Apparently, Mara and Call was based as a mashup of Mark's name, Wendy's name, and another neighbor that he had a friendship with named Colette. And so I myself was wondering why not Colette? Oh, yeah. But why not Colette? And they even mentioned what happened to Colette. Oh, she moved. It's like, it's more like there's like these two, and another two big things that are running themes throughout the movie is like, hey, the court date's coming up and you need to be there. And so that the judge will see you because somehow you being there will make the judge sentence these guys harder. And then there's also, oh, by the way, you also have your big opening. This is the big night, you know, of your life. And somehow these two events conveniently happen on the same day, thanks to the magic of movies. And it's one of those things where you get the sense that in the documentary that Mark Hogenkamp's sort of recovery was slow. It was arduous. It was imperfect. There were a lot of times that he fell backwards. Here, this movie kind of just, again, takes the Hollywood route where it's like, we're going to just hit all of these sort of typical milestones in a typical standard three-act screenplay, and by the end, you'll walk out feeling great. And it just feels tawdry in the end. It feels cheap.
We'll keep going into your final thoughts.
I'm disappointed in this, but I'm disappointed in the sense that, not because this was a bad movie, but it had the potential to be something even better, and it was based on such great source material. We see a lot of bad movies. You know it's going to be bad. It's bad. You move on. This is disappointing because it just could have been better, and it had that in there. And I think Robert Zemeckis has it in him to make that movie. He just chose not to this time around. Good effort, but ultimately didn't work for me. I give this 4 out of 10 egregious movie references.
Yeah, Zemeckis, what are you? Chicken.
You know, I want to go back in time and fix this script. But, you know, I don't think there's enough power and love in me to say anything better about it.
All right, Frank.
Okay, well, complete 180 from that final thought.
Whatever the hell that was.
He just said, if that final thought was something I could squat over and drop a poop on, then he would be doing it right now.
No. I've got no more shits to give. I'm Kathy Griffin.
Oh, I disagree. I heard what you said about Vice.
Oh, my God.
We'll get to that.
We're going to get to Vice, yes. No, I...
Anyway, I'll soundtrack your review.
No, I... Okay, so I said this on the Mary Poppins review last night. So I just got dumped 2 weeks ago, so I'm feeling very, like, low and in the dumps and in a tailspin. So I sort of get the whole...
You're that guy?
I'm that guy, yes.
Single and ready to mingle.
Yeah, if you see a guy out there for me, just tell him to stay the fuck away from me. Because it's
a magical day.
And we'll pay for it.
Please stay away because it's only going to end badly. But so I sort of get the whole like feeling alone and feeling sort of like, you know, like you can't, don't really run and relate to anybody on the outside and you don't want to have to go outside unless you have to go outside. And instead of dolls, I've got award screeners to watch, which is really cool.
Which weirdly you've arranged into like a whole bunch of like characters in a World War II new Belgian town.
I can make a fort.
Yeah.
It just says Netflix and it's two of everything. My God. True. But yeah, no, I think this movie really, it depends on, it's going to be, I understand why people would not embrace this film. It is very, very hard to categorize. It's not clear cut. But I loved it. Maybe it is because I'm going through, you know, something that's very sort of like bleh right now. But I sort of got this guy who didn't want to or couldn't, you know, process and heal in the conventional way, that he had to go ahead and find some sort of coping mechanism. And I love movies that have blended tones anyways. And I love the softer real life aspects when he was trying to get to know Leslie Mann, who, by the way, my gosh, she's just so just ethereal in every movie she's in, even if she's in a throwaway part like this. And Steve Carell is just, you know, God, this is one of his better performances, I think. But I think this movie, it's not going to be for, you know, the cynical moviegoer. It's going to be for somebody that it really is going to be like a litmus test for cinematic empathy, I guess, in a way. And it depends on what your own experiences are when you see it, probably, and how good you are at coping with whatever you're going through. But I dug it. I love the fact that it just was zigging and zagging all the way around. I think it's a beautiful mess, and I think it's a really interesting mess. And I think it's going to be for very specific people who will latch onto it, like me. And, you know, this is probably the movie I needed to see right now, and I'm glad I did. I'm going to give this 9 out of 10. Diane Kruger's, only because that was the one aspect of this film that just took me completely out of what I was watching. I did not like Diane Kruger.
There's that point where you're like, oh, that's what, that's not that great.
I mean, it's not that great. No, I think you could have taken out that, what the fuck is she called?
Deja Thoris.
Deja Thoris.
Apparently a Conan villain, I think.
Even that name. I'm like, I was like, get her out of there. I mean,
she's basically drugs.
We got Nazis. That's all we need.
She's the green fairy.
We got Nazis. We don't need Diane Kruger.
I kept thinking they were going to look at his prescription bottle and be like, Deja Thorazine or something. Oh, that explains it.
But
Alan, what about you?
Okay. Well, to go 180 in the other direction again.
wow. You're getting our listeners with right now.
I'm getting the spins.
I think this is one of the worst movies I've seen this year.
Oh, like, wow.
I really, really, really disliked it. And I was thinking about it while we're sitting here. We're talking about it. I think the issue is, this is a very human story that wants to be told here, and I think Zemeckis is just the complete wrong director for that. Even if his best movies aren't terribly human, they might have some emotion to them, but like you think of his best work, it's not rooted in like real human emotion and like the depths of it, in my opinion. Chris is giving me the raised eyebrows, but that's where I'm going with it.
Cars is a masterpiece.
When you say that, I just look at Jodie Foster's face in Contact, and she's going through the wormhole, and I'm thinking, you're wrong.
Well, but anyways, that'd be...
You even insinuate a word against Back to the Future.
It's not a terribly, like... It's a great movie. It's one of my favorite movies of all time.
I cry every time I watch it, so I don't know what you're talking about.
So either that, or you just... If you say any shit, you're going to end up in the Richard Club. You don't want to be in the Richard Club.
I'm saying he's the wrong director for this. And if he ever could tell a human story, he hasn't done it in a very long time. 2 decades.
True.
Like, at least, I mean, maybe 3. I don't know. It's bad. It's been bad for a while. And I imagine, like, if someone like Spike Jonze did this movie... If like this script came to him, or if he had
that'd be an interesting movie to watch.
Like, you think about like where the Wild Things are,
yeah,
and like you just see an idea of what this movie like could be with like the material you work with and the type of people and characters you have.
Yeah,
it could be incredible. And instead, we have like a ride at Disneyland or something with all this like terrible addiction and beating and Nazis in it. And it's like, this is not
good. I love Beautiful Tragedy though, don't you?
Yeah, but I don't think this is either. The movie doesn't really portray that tragedy all that well or the beauty. It's just really flat to me across the board with some impressive CGI.
Okay.
I'm going 2 out of 10 really awful puns.
Wow. Flight was pretty human.
I'm gonna say
yes, it was. Oh my gosh!
No, I mean,
what's more human than alcoholism?
I really like Flight. I wish it was a better film than it was, but I really enjoyed it. I think that's a solid Zemeckis film. I think the thing with Zemeckis is it's just been so long since he's made an absolute classic. I think he's made plenty of good films. He just hasn't made a classic in a while. Mm. I mean, I even like the ones people like give shit. Like, The Polar Express is, on paper, a pretty good movie. It's just that Uncanny Valley thing is hard to
Well, it's also kind of fucking boring to watch.
And I actually genuinely enjoy his A Christmas Carol. I get it. That same Uncanny Valley problem, but I actually thought that was pretty solid.
I forgot that was a thing.
Castaway is pretty solid, you know?
There was that decade where he said, I'm just going to do animated films.
Yeah.
And then he kind of like...
Castaway might be the last good one to me.
Yeah.
Everything else has been okay.
But I do want to say, I think Carell, like, picks the right way to play this part.
Yes.
Despite the issues with this movie, and I don't deny that it has big issues, I think Carell is really charming in this and finds that niche in a really difficult role to play. I mean, he is such a... It's so many things going on here. I can only imagine that, like, he spent a lot of time probably talking to the actual guy going, what am I supposed to do?
this guy's harder to play than Donald Rumsfeld.
Right?
Yeah.
And Leslie Mann is charming and beautiful as hell. She's wonderful in a part that, unfortunately, shouldn't have been in this movie at all. But she's great in it. Not like she's really great in it, but it shouldn't have been in the movie. It should not have been the way this film was. A lot of Merritt Weaver actually deserves some special attention because she's not in it a lot, but when she is, she's quite good and very memorable.
She's living in that Jenna Fisher sort of like.
And she's the only person who doesn't look like a doll. That, you know, all of the dolls that everyone has, like. You know, they're basically Hollywood actresses, and they're kind of beautiful, although Gwendolyn Christie's got that Amazon view. But Merritt Weaver looks like the lady who works behind the cash register.
She does, she does.
You know, also, maybe I hated the end of this whole, like, oh, the girl's been in front of me all along thing.
For somebody going through that, it takes a while for them to recognize what's in front of them, though.
I will say, though, like, Isaac Gonzalez, like... super fucking model, working prep cook in a shitty who constantly is dressing like a Spanish supermodel. Yeah. What are you wearing in this scene? And what's up at court wearing like she's about to go sing the Carmina Burana song.
She looks like she pulled up in a limo on a red carpet like, walking to the
bar. Honey, you ain't never worked short order cook.
She's still at the Baby Driver
premiere.
You've
never been in the back of the kitchen looking like that.
There's some astonishingly... not well thought out aspects to this film, no question. No. There's some stuff I'm like, why isn't this better? And man, you said like Charlie Kaufman writing this, that would have been the way to go. And it wouldn't have mattered. He would have found a way, even if it did go way off from the actual story, to make it work. I don't care that it doesn't really stick as close to the original story, except for the points where it's unnecessary and feels awkward, which happens a lot in this film. But I did think there was a lot of charm, nonetheless. The third act, I think, works pretty damn well. And I actually really liked the CG animation stuff.
I did, too. It was so beautiful.
Like I said, I have big issues, but ultimately, I think this is a movie that... I mean, obviously, very mixed review here in the room. I think you should see it and decide for yourself. I have a feeling people who have seen and loved Marwyn Call are going to have more problems with it than people who haven't. And yes, if I had to say, which movie should you see? I'd say...
Mary Poppins Returns.
Go see Marwyn Call, not Welcome to Marwyn. But that being said, I did have some fun with this. I'm going to give it 6.5 out of 10 carefully hidden Mr. Fusion machines. Because it was there, motherfucker. I saw it.